right, everybody. We could go ahead and get started. I know we're on a little bit of a timeline. We have to be out of here by 11, and hopefully we'll beat that timeline. Let's go ahead and call this meeting of COGFA to order, and if we could do roll.
Representative Bennett. Representative Davidsmeyer. Senator DeWitt. Senator Kaler. Representative Harper. Representative Hernandez. Representative Moeller. Senator Sims. Representative Sosnowski. Senator Staines. Senator Severson. Senator Tracy.
With 10 present, we have a quorum. I want to thank everybody for coming in this morning. I want to thank all of our members for being here timely so we can get moving. And I want to thank, on behalf of myself and Chairman Staines, I want to thank COG for all the work that they do behind the scenes. I think we're going to go ahead and start with the overview of the fiscal year 2020 group insurance program. If we could have CMS and Morneau Chappelle come forward. And please introduce yourselves and give an intro.
There we go. Good morning. Janelle Ford, Acting Director of Central Management Services.
I'm Kerry McKenzie. I'm a Senior Vice President with Morneau Chappelle.
All right. And if I may address the committee. Good morning, Co-Chair Staines and Davis Myers and members of the commission. My name is Janelle Ford, and I am pleased to be here today. I'm grateful for the opportunity to serve as Acting Director of the Department of Central Management Services, a position I have held since January 2019. In short order, I've learned a lot in the past 13 weeks or so on the job and look forward to working in partnership with the members of the Commission to provide efficient and quality service to all of our stakeholders. If I may, before we take your questions, I would like to comment briefly on something we consider very important. The Auditor General's recent report and findings you may be aware of regarding its Morneau Chappelle audit. First, I have learned a great deal in a short time on the subject, and I have been helped by the dedicated CMS staff. Those individuals are here with me today. The work on this contract award began in fall 2015. Many of the challenges and operational issues regarding our statewide benefits programs were incurred by the previous administration and were addressed in large part by the spring of 2018, before the arrival of a new administration and a new leadership team. In a nutshell, CMS agrees with the Auditor General's findings and recommendations throughout the audit, mainly showing that the overly aggressive time frame and the RFP issued in 2015 resulted in only a single bidder for the project, system transition issues, and a resulting failure by the vendor to initially meet contractual performance guarantees. I can tell you that my review of this contract award and the vendor since January has convinced me that the CMS team has and will continue to identify and implement appropriate corrective actions based on the audit review itself, as well as the team's own findings. Based on customer satisfaction surveys, our benefit service systems for covered workers, retirees, and their dependents is providing quality service, even as further improvements and corrective actions are being made to ensure better member access and services, fewer processing errors, compliance with the law, and full accountability. During the 12 months since April 2018, surveys show a 96% satisfaction rate for customer services under the new system, 81% of members completed self-service enrollment online, saving significant time. Payroll processing errors were reduced from an 8% average under the old paper system to less than 1% currently. The vendor, Morneau Chapelle, has met all 18 contract performance guarantees for the first full year since the contract was awarded. The contract was amended to include a 17% annual BEP goal going forward, and we continue to monitor the vendor's monthly performance and enforce all contractual guarantees. For today's hearing, I have asked our benefit service leadership team to help us respond to your questions, many of whom you know, Deputy Director Teresa Flesch and Colin Brewer, our benefit CFO. Under a new administration and CMS leadership, we are focusing on operational excellence and efficiency throughout CMS, and our benefits program is crucial in that ongoing effort. This concludes my prepared remarks. We always welcome your advice, and we are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Would you like to make any statement to start out?
So, like I said, I'm Kerry McKenzie. I'm with Morneau Chapelle. I'm a senior vice president there, responsible for benefits technology delivery, specifically in the United States. We've been engaged with CMS since 2016, an opportunity that we've been very grateful to have. I think it's well documented that there were some challenges along the way, and as the director alluded to, mainly caused by an accelerated implementation time frame, which wasn't ideal. Since then, we've worked through the majority of the issues, and believe we're well positioned for being successful going forward. We talked about the fact that we've made improvements in certain areas, and we will continue to look for ways to improve the experience for the members. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Director Ford, what is the current amount of claims backlog, and do we know how long vendors in the group insurance program, how long the waiting period is?
So the current claims hold is approximately $1.6 billion, about 6 months for the self-insured program folks in the program, and 7 months for the fully insured.
Okay. I'm sorry, and how much did you say is currently owed in interest, did you say?
I did not say.
Okay.
Colin Brewer, $162
million. $162 million, okay. All right. A couple other questions. Where are we at on union negotiations? Do we know where that stands?
So we are currently in dialogue with the unions. We are having a productive and a respectful conversation, so it's ongoing, but they've been productive.
Okay. And do we know where the savings are for the group health? I know that in the proposed budget, there was some form of savings on the group health side, mm-hmm. and I don't know where we were proposing to save those dollars.
Sure. So initially proposed in our FY20 budget were some savings, and I'll outline them, and if we need additional detail, we can have the folks on the team provide some additional context. First was regarding a reissue of the DEVA audit, so that's our dependent eligibility and verification audit. The last time we implemented that a few years ago, the savings were approximately $30 million, and so we look forward to doing that again. It is timely. The second initiative was a market check on prescription drugs. It's an industry best practice to ensure that we are receiving the best prices on the prescription drugs that we're obviously using through our plan. Again, the timing is appropriate for us to be doing that now. Third is a claims audit for self-insured medical plans. Teresa Flesch can talk more if you like more detail about that. And the last is regarding our Medicare Advantage prescription drug program. So looking at enhancements in that program are twofold. One is looking at split families, and so allowing for Medicare-eligible folks to be able to, independents to be part of the program. And then the non being separated out. And then the second is a rolling MAPD process. So that's just really a timing play. Instead of waiting for one open enrollment period, if someone is eligible at X time, then we're bringing them onto the system sooner rather than later.
Okay. Do we have any other questions from members? Senator DeWitt.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. McKenzie, welcome. So your fee structure for this package is $94 million.
Over the 10-year
over
period.
Over the 10-year, that's for the entire period of the contract?
That's for the entire period, yes.
Okay. And you receive no other commissions or payments from any of the carriers involved in any of these contracts?
Not currently.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. McKenzie, I'm curious. The contract term is for 10 years. You say it's $94 million over the terms of the complete term of the contract. Is that right?
That is correct.
So the work that Morneau Chapelle was doing that was shifted to a call center in Atlanta. Is that right?
Well, it wasn't shifted. So initially when we started this project, our contact center was in Atlanta. I think over time as we try to enhance the program, we've moved call centers around. I think currently today we take most of your calls in Pittsburgh, and we have an overflow center in Tampa.
So the call centers was originally in Georgia,
yep,
then moved to Pittsburgh.
Correct.
But there are no employees currently working in Illinois on this contract.
Well, we do. So Kevin Canoon, who's in the audience behind me, he lives in Illinois. Morneau Chapelle currently have over 105 employees in Illinois. From time to time, some of them may be working on this contract. The majority of the people who work on the contract are situated in Pittsburgh, but we do have over 800 employees in the U.S., of which 105 are presently in Illinois.
Director, the contract that we are currently in with Morneau Chapelle, what is the termination clause for the contract? If we wanted to exit the contract, what are the terms?
I'd have to get back to you through the chair.
Okay. Because I'm interested to know, so where are we with the comptroller's decision to suspend payments to Morneau Chapelle?
So we have worked with the thank you for your question. We've worked with the comptroller's office. They raised some questions to us, and we provided a response, and they have released the administrative hold on the payments to Morneau Chapelle based on our feedback and our documentation.
Okay. Well, I'd be interested to see the termination clause and what that might mean for us, because
mm-hmm.
that would to me, it should be something we should be exploring. While I know as you mentioned in your opening comments, some of the problems that have been experienced have been rectified.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the audit, what the auditors say is correct, most of these services could have been and were being done in house. So I think that's something we need to be looking at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Ford. So, do I understand correctly then? If you gave the go ahead to the comptroller's office, you gave them feedback that you believe that the payment should be released in May. So, and what's that based on then?
So the feedback that we provided to the comptroller's office is consistent with the contract management that we've been doing internally here at CMS. On a monthly basis, we look at performance guarantees, which we can provide through the chair, which obviously look at Morneau Chapelle's compliance with the contract. And so based on their meeting and or exceeding the performance guarantees, we requested the comptroller's office release the administrative payments to the vendor.
And okay, so and how are so you think they're meeting all their contract requirements?
Yes, the 18 performance guarantees.
And so my understanding was that there were some problems with the portal, that there were employees who were getting deleted from the system, unable to obtain their insurance benefits. Is that no longer the case then, or is that not part of what was required in the contract, was getting that employee portal correct?
So I know that we've experienced in the past some issues with the portal, and my understanding is that those issues there's obviously always potentials for issues, that those issues have since been resolved. But I'll ask Teresa Flesch to talk a little bit more about details around the portal. And Teresa Flesch is our Deputy Director of Benefits.
Good morning. So yes, early on we did have issues with the portal, but we were able to resolve those issues immediately, and we actually put steps in place to make sure that there were no access to care issues, which were people making sure that when they went to the doctor or the pharmacy, they could pick up the prescriptions. So we have not encountered any problems for probably about a year and a half.
Okay, so big picture, we enter a contract over 10 years, the value of about $94 million, is it? And I think originally we were supposed to be achieving $500 million in savings for the state by creating a metal-tiered plan, which never got implemented, so we've just been paying, I think, primarily just for the portal, which I guess had problems, has now been fixed, and we have a lot of audit outstanding concerns, things not getting reported, conflicts of interest that weren't, employees didn't fill out, is, you know, there are a lot of concerns on that. Is that, and yet, do you believe then that we should, I mean, one, is that an accurate sort of overall assessment? And I'm wondering then if you think we should be taking a look at whether or not we should be continuing on with the contract.
No, we've addressed every issue that the audit had identified. Some of the audit findings were related to more CPO issues and their responsibilities are what they expect the agencies to do. So everything's been rectified. The confidentiality statements was one of the items identified in the audit, and that has been fixed.
So you think we're getting appropriate value out of the contract at this point?
Absolutely. And we are also, there's a lot that we're doing to protect members' personal health information. Keep in mind there used to be thousands of pieces of paper floating around every state agency, board, commission, and university with Social Security numbers on them. That doesn't happen anymore. So although it was a rough start, there are a lot of good things that have come out of this that actually protects the state, and we are also able to be more compliant with IRS regulations where people were backdating forms in the past. If they'd missed deadlines, their 30 or 60 day window for opportunity to change things, we fixed all that with this portal.
Okay, and have we achieved any savings out of the group health program as a result of the contract?
Not at this point, but the impetus behind this, like you said, was the $500 million in savings was related to the implementation of the metal bands. And that was connected to union negotiations, and we were at impasse, so we were never able to implement that. But had we been able to implement the metal bands, Morneau was absolutely a necessity in that. We could not have done that in-house, as well as what somebody outside could have done.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Cisnowski.
Sorry about that.
Good morning. House members haven't learned how to use mics.
Let's try that again here. Sorry, turned it on too early. Quick question. I might have missed it. The $162 million dollar number I think you mentioned in regards to interest, and I'm just looking at the State Employee Group of Health Insurance liability chart that was in the backup here from COGFA. Where did that number come from again? Is that, when were those payments made?
So I'll have Colin Brewer, the benefit CFO, come to answer that question.
Good morning. Colin Brewer, CFO for CMS Benefits. The $162 million number represents the amount of interest payments that are due to providers that are currently that have not been paid yet, including any interest that is currently also accruing on any bills that haven't been paid. Now, we've shipped a lot of vouchers over to the comptroller for the payment of interest, but based on the state's overall financial condition and the ability for the comptroller to be able to provide us with general revenue funds, we've been working with them in a manner to periodically release certain amounts of that interest out to the vendors so that we are not just paying out a bunch of interest, which then forces us to hold on to extra bills, which are then just accruing more interest. So we've been trying to work in earnest with the comptroller to get that out the door little by little. That number, I'm not sure exactly what you're looking at, but the figures that are in the COGFA report on the liabilities of the group insurance program, those are really more representative of the interest that's incurred or accrued in a given year, as opposed to the 162, which is really a lot of interest that's really still left over from the $3.9 billion that we spent out in the bond money. So kind of an apples and oranges comparison there.
Okay, so if I look at FY 2018 showed that we accrued about $260 million in interest payments, and then FY 2019 another $33 million. So that's accrued interest that's due, not necessarily that's paid. I say that accurately?
That's correct.
Okay, so 162 million of that, is all of that currently at the comptrollers waiting to be paid and submitted to them, or that's
some of the 162 is actually interest that has accrued as of today on bills that have yet to be paid. So we keep track of our interest in real time every single day. So the number that I'm giving you is as of April 30th, the interest that is on bills that have already been paid, and now I've got an interest voucher that's just sitting at the comptroller versus a bill that hasn't been paid, but it's accrued so much to date.
So then do we feel pretty confident then, looking at FY20, additional interest that will be accrued will only be about $4 million then?
That is the current projection. That is predicated on the governor's budget proposal that includes a $900 million bond issuance with a larger than $900 million bond issuance, but $900 million coming to the group insurance program, giving us the ability to buy down the hold cycle prior to June 30th. And assuming revenues are consistent through the budget year, being able to maintain that low hold cycle throughout the budget year would result in those reduced projections of interest liability.
Okay, so on that $162 million, we're looking at maybe a couple months. If that passes successfully, there'd only be a couple more months accruing interest on that $162 million, and essentially you're saying all of that would be paid down through that bonding?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
As part of the process, have we reduced headcount at CMS, specifically in the Bureau of Benefits? Have we seen any reduction?
I'll have Teresa Flesh answer that question.
Are you referencing the implementation of Morneau-Chapelle impacting?
Yes, yes.
No, we have not seen reduced headcount.
Okay, is there an expectation that there would be in the future?
Early on, we thought through attrition that we just may not fill some positions, but we're not at that point yet.
Okay, is that because you're still working with Morneau-Chapelle to make sure that this is all working correctly, or are they shifting to other areas?
No, we're working with Morneau-Chapelle. And actually, even the group insurance reps out in the agency, we were wanting to free up their time to work reports that they don't have time to do or didn't have time to do in the old system. So it's a higher level of work that we're expecting of people.
Okay, so they're going through reports to, I mean,
payroll reports to make sure insurance deductions are right, things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, please add Senator. Representative Mueller to the roll.
Do we have any more questions? Seeing none, I think we can move forward with the VSI, and I think we're going to keep CMS up here for possibly a few more questions for the vendor support initiative as well. Can we bring forward, is Brian Hines in?
Thank you.
Patrick? I'm gonna ask you to pronounce your name. I don't wanna butcher it.
Again.
Sorry. Patrick Dolady.
Thank
Director
you.
Of Marketing.
Thank you. And I think we've got vendor capital finance. We may have to split this up to make sure that we have plenty of room up here. Would you guys like to make a quick statement on the VSI?
Sure, sure. Commissioner Staines and Davidsmeyer, and members of the commission, my name is Brian Hines. I'm the founder of Vendor Assistance Program. I'm accompanied by my colleague, Patrick Dolady. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. VAP, our company, is proud to have been the first qualified purchaser under the state's vendor payment program. We are the largest qualified purchaser. By way of numbers, to date, total, we have purchased a little over $5.1 billion of receivables over the last few years. $4 billion or so has gone through the state program, vendor payment program, vendor support initiative, and a little over $1.1 billion We've purchased from vendors who didn't qualify for the program but still had a need for liquidity because of the state's payment cycles. Today we have a little over $300 million currently outstanding to vendors. About $250 million of that is through the vendor payment program, and about $60 million, again, is to other vendors that don't qualify for the program but come to us and have liquidity needs. We're proud to have assisted over 400 vendors, large and small, in the state of Illinois. We're proud that through our efforts we've helped those vendors keep their doors open, keep their lights on, make payroll, and live up to their contractual obligations to serve some of the neediest citizens of the state of Illinois. We're proud that we also helped with state employees, retirees, beneficiaries, legislators, to pay the health care during the budget impasse. And that's what the qualified purchasers and everyone's here today. You know, we believe we are a large part of helping the state stay afloat during the impasse with the health care providers and also with other vendors of the state of Illinois. And as we sit here today, we think that our efforts and the efforts of the other qualified purchasers and of vendors who didn't participate in the program but withstood the late payments from the state and still met their contractual obligations and still served the neediest citizens of the state of Illinois, the state has come out of the budget impasse, and we're looking at numbers like we're just mentioned about COGFA. You know, the projected number for penalties for next fiscal year for health insurance is $3.6 million. Put that in, you know, 2 years ago as we sat here today, that projected number was $335 million. So the state is making steps to get its fiscal house in order. We're proud that we've helped the state to do that and to get through the impasse. But I would be remiss to say, you know, we, as one of the companies, and again, not just the qualified purchasers, other vendors too who withstood late payments, it still is a little difficult to comprehend, you know, how late we are getting paid in the penalty. The most recent base invoice for health insurance that was paid was for the August 2018 monthly capitation payment. Okay. The last monthly penalty payment that was made was for April of 2016. So whether it be vendors that flow to the state or qualified purchasers that stepped in and helped those companies, we're waiting 3 years for the penalties to get paid for health insurance. And I don't know what the answer is. We proposed different ideas over the last couple of years, but it is a challenge and it is a problem. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Director Ford, could you kind of go through how the VSI works through CMS?
Sure. I'll have Colin Brewer talk you through how the VSI program works.
Hi again. I can speak specifically to how VSI has been working with regard to the group insurance program. Obviously, this program is larger than just that, but generally speaking, the same procedures take place. A qualified purchaser and a vendor will communicate a desire to purchase and a desire to sell a receivable. That information is then requested of CMS, of specifically the receivable information that's out there, the invoice date, the payment amount, and things of that nature. And then when an agreement is made between the qualified purchaser and the vendor, information is then sent over to the comptroller, who records that transaction and changes the payment address on the voucher that has been sitting over there, such that it'll be directed typically to a trust fund held by the qualified purchaser. So whenever we release that payment, then the comptroller knows that it has been assigned to a QP and where the money gets directed. And then subsequently, when the interest payment is released, it follows that same process.
Do you know if there's been any problems with paying a vendor instead of paying the VSI or something like that?
There have been, and it has, and I can't speak to all of the details. My fiscal operations manager handles all of the nitty-gritty, but we've been constantly working with the comptroller where there has been any address issues. And I know one vendor changed their mailing address, and it kind of messed up a few things, but we're finding out about these things, you know, like within a 1 or 2 day period, getting with the comptroller, trying to rectify the situation as much as possible.
Okay. What's the dollar amount of backlog claims currently being financed through the program right now? Do you know?
For the group insurance program, we've sold a total of about $4.3 billion worth of receivables through the four different qualified purchasers, and there is about $360 million still waiting to be repaid.
Okay. And how much interest has been paid out?
We've paid out about almost $500 million has been incurred, and we've paid out a little over 300.
Okay. And that 300 has actually been paid and sent out from the comptroller, or just sent to the comptroller?
That goes back to our question about the $162 million that's sitting over at the comptroller.
Okay.
Most of our prompt payment interest. Virtually all of our bills at this point are getting purchased by qualified purchasers. So any interest that is sitting over there is probably due to a qualified purchaser.
Okay. So you said four currently that are able to purchase these?
I believe there are, I don't know the entire program, I know who I work with,
okay,
but I believe there are five qualified purchasers that have been certified and eligible to operate under the program. Our little part of the world, group insurance, deals with four of those five.
Okay. Could the state employee group insurance program continue to operate without this program?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I don't know if I can answer that. I could give you my opinion, and that's all it would be. We were clearly in a very bad financial position prior to the $3.9 billion, and that was obviously what kept the program up, was the ability for our vendors to, you know, to access capital through this program. We've obviously purchased the hold cycle down quite a bit, so I can't truly answer the question. I can maybe only give you the bit of information is that given our current hold cycle, which is much less than it used to be, vendors are still interested in selling their receivables. Is that an indication that they would be unwilling to work with the state if they couldn't? I don't know, but I do know they sell them.
So it could be difficult. Okay. Senator Kaler.
Along the same lines, I think that's a good question. seems to me that this was devised as a transition strategy till we got to more stable times. And so when does this begin to taper down?
Well, from one perspective, the information that you see in COGFA's report shows the hold cycles for our fully insured vendors going down to about 3 months. That's obviously, as I said, predicated on receiving $900 million worth of bond money, but prompt payment being a three-month cycle, there would be very little interest generated. I would think that the cost of doing transactions, the amount of work that it takes, it would probably not be, you would probably not find the interest of the QPs wanting to continue to do the business with that little return. Obviously, the vendors at a 90-day hold cycle would have the ability to manage their cash much better. So in this budget proposed by the governor, I would expect, as presented in the report, that there would not be much need in the group insurance world. I think the program could still operate outside of that, where there are other vendors that are being paid directly through GRF, where there is still a considerable hold cycle. Now, all that being said, I still have to work with the comptroller on an ongoing basis to get them to give me the GRF to fund the program. and we are not completely up to date in terms of the money that I have requested. So will I ever truly be able to get to the 90 days? I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. That being said, we might get there.
I mean, I understand that we've been, the reason to cause this business to survive and flourish here, but I think there's expectation that this all phases out and that we get our act together. So that's what we're working towards, is what I hear you saying.
Senator Sims.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious. You just mentioned that, well, I think you're getting some advice from counsel. That's all right. I'll wait. I want to make sure you got the advice you need. So you just mentioned you're having struggles with the controller to get the GRF necessary to fund the program. So about how much would you say you're behind? So you've got HRF payments. Oh, how much? How much have you made in HRF payments over the last several years?
Well, as the director testified to earlier, we're sitting on about $1.6 billion worth of bills.
Uh-huh.
It really depends on the time of the month and which month of the year. We're constantly in communication with folks from the comptroller's office in terms of our needs for paying bills and how that works in with the overall system, general state aid to schools, debt service, and things like that. I can get the answer for you. I don't know exactly how much money is owed to me from the comptroller compared to what I've requested, but I'd be happy to get that to you.
But when was the last payment paid for the program?
We received probably $80 million in cash about a week and a half ago, I think it was.
Okay, and then does that include the interest penalties paid?
Well, that is the revenue that's coming into the program from the comptroller through the general revenue fund. I kind of treat that separately in terms of how the money goes out.
Okay.
It's used to the money that's coming in, plus member contributions, other funds reimbursements, and various other revenue sources are, kind of bundled and then used to manage the outgoing money for our self-insured claims that require bank fundings and our monthly fully insured vendors. Interest is also given a consideration there, but as I said before, we've been working with the comptroller to try to whittle down that amount of outstanding interest over a period of time.
So, Mr. Hines, I mean, I know from vendor assistance program, what was the last payment that VAP received in terms of payment for penalties, but also your HRF payments?
So the last HRF monthly payment we received was about 10 days ago, and it was for the August 2018 base invoice amount. The last penalty we received was in December of 2018, and that was for the April 2016 penalty voucher.
So wait a minute, make sure I just heard you right. So the last penalty payment you got was for April 16 claims.
Correct.
So you've not received anything for penalties from then to penalty payments from then till now.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So I'd be interested to have a more detailed discussion about the cash flow you've got on hand to help you manage the program, because that's disturbing. If we've got a penalty payment that has not been paid since, or we're paying penalty claims from 3 years ago, to Senator Kaler's point, how are we catching up? So it does not sound like we're on the verge of catching up. So I'd be interested to have that more detailed discussion.
Yeah, I'm happy to help you with any information you need.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think, why don't we have the other three, if they have a statement, Vendor Capital Finance, PayPlant, Illinois Finance Partners. Do any of you want to make a statement? And then we were going to see if somebody from the comptroller's office wants to come up and have some comments to add about how the program's working and the interest penalty payments being paid or not.
Good morning. My name is Gregory Gack. I'm a co-founder of Illinois Financing Partners. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here again. This is our third year in front of COGFA, and we welcome the opportunity to meet with the legislature whenever we can on this important topic. IFP became a qualified purchaser in 2016, and we have to date purchased more than $1.2 billion worth of group health premiums, premium payments from group health providers. Since the last COGFA, we have bought about $350 million worth of group health vouchers. These vouchers allow the continuation of coverage for more than 80,000 state employees and their dependents. At the 2018 COGFA hearing, we were talking about prompt payment penalties related to invoices that were paid in November of 2017. And since then, or since that hearing, but before that hearing, none of those payments, none of the prompt payment penalties had been made on the November 17 base invoice payments. This was in violation of the state regulations, the joint regulations, which require that these payments be made in a reasonable time. Since the 2018 COGFA hearings, $30 million has still not been paid, and these are the November 2017 payments. We are very concerned about the state's circumvention of its own law, the PPP Act, the Prompt Payment Penalty Act, and its noncompliance with its own regulations. And it's not a matter of having funds available. All of the group health invoices that we purchased in 2018, all 350 million of them, have been paid. None of the related prompt payment penalties have been paid. This conduct is detrimental to the qualified purchasers, the group health program, and ultimately the state's reputation. IFP was not profitable last year in 2018. The situation that we have right now is not sustainable as it relates to the vendor payment program. The failure to pay the statutorily required amounts means that interest to our lenders continues to leave the state and is not available for the qualified purchasers to recycle the funds into additional purchases or to the group health companies who ultimately receive some of the funds that haven't been paid. And this ultimately raises costs for everyone. Now, IFP is willing to remain in the program, but there have to be some fundamental changes so that the qualified purchasers remain viable. IFP has always maintained that there are more financially efficient ways of financing these obligations to vendors. As long as the vendor payment program is useful to the state, it's important that the rules be respected, not just by the qualified purchasers, but by all branches of the government as well. I echo all of the comments that were made by our competitors at Vendor Assistance Program and want to make sure that we decide whether or not there are better ways of doing this, but if there are, we would like to be a participant or not a participant, but we would like to see the current program start to live by the rules that have been promulgated and the laws that have been passed. Thank you for some of the legislators who have met with us over the past year on this topic, and we hope that there will be some action coming soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Nirav Berry. I'm the CEO and co-founder of PayPlant. We've been a qualified purchaser since 2016. And to date, we've purchased $196 million worth of invoices. Our outstanding right now is right around $10.5 million. So majority of the invoices have been paid. However, majority of the interest has not been paid. And none of the interest we've accrued for the insurance receivables has been paid. So we're owed about $8.3 million. Thank you.
Hi, Lee Chen, manager of Vendor Capital Finance. You know, to be frank, we enjoy our relationship with the state, and we've got nothing further to add.
Thank you, Representative Sosnowski.
I guess it's a minor question for the department, but
By the testimony, it sounds like there's a little bit of a discrepancy where the first testimony, we're still waiting on payments from 2016. IFP is, and this is just on the penalty, IFP is waiting on, a little bit better off it sounds, they're waiting on penalty payments from November 17. Is there any reason why there is a one-year disparity in paid out penalties?
We process all of our payments on a first-in, first-out basis. We send as immediately when the bill has been warranted by the comptroller, a prompt payment voucher is generated, and we immediately send that over there. The real reason why there's a discrepancy in the timing of the interest payments to the vendors is based on when they actually purchased. So if they purchased a bill from 18 and then it gets paid, that interest kind of goes into the queue. Somebody purchased a bill that was a lot older and then that got paid, their interest is going to obviously get paid before one that's purchased at a later date.
Okay, so nothing that the comptroller is just at their discretion as far as where what part gets paid first, it's just in a queue as
we're,
far as
we're giving them all of the information that they need to release both invoice payments and interest payments on a first-in, first-out basis.
I don't want to dive too much into the details, but why would there be like a one-year difference in the purchase of the the debt?
If I may, yeah. There, part of that was definitional. The November 17th date was the date that we received the base invoice payments for invoices that were dated 2015 and 2016. We have not seen prompt payment penalty payments on 2016 invoices yet.
I gotcha.
Some
okay.
of them, yes.
So you're basically in the same.
Get the same. Yeah, same yeah. VAP and IFP are very similar
okay.
in terms
so
of.
So everybody's got the same problem dating back to 2016.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. I appreciate the clarification.
And we will we'll have somebody come up from the comptroller's office as well. Is there are there any other questions?
So what's the mechanism if we is there a mechanism in place if we decide we no longer need the vendor assistant program to wind it down? How would is that something that CMS can just do?
Well, I can't. Well, I will tell you from a policy and a programmatic perspective, we have our deputy general counsel that can answer statutorily what we're obligated to do. We look forward to a day when we do not need the program. That requires a level of financial stability that we don't currently have. I will tell you personally that since I've been in role, I've talked to the team about what that we're parallel pathing, so what do we need to do to think differently about the program, but also what would it take to unwind the program. So the hope is that we don't, quite frankly, need the program, and we are looking at that. We're not there yet, but we are looking programmatically on what that takes and what we would need to do to be able to do that.
And the Treasurer's Office now has the capability of also purchasing bills from vendors. Have they purchased any in the group health space, or where have they been purchasing? Do you know?
It doesn't operate exactly like the vendor program. They're not really purchasing.
Yeah.
What they're doing is they're loaning GRF money that is not necessarily due or obligated to other financial responsibilities within the state, and then GRF is essentially paying them back at a lower interest rate than prompt pay. So they're really just advancing us the cash to relieve us the 12% that's accruing on prompt pay, and then when the money comes in from GRF, they're paying the treasurer back at like 4 or 4.5 or
and
something.
And are you using that in the group health space?
We have received two different times money through that mechanism.
How much?
I do not remember at the moment. I can get that for you.
Okay, and I assume that that's part of the calculation in terms of whether the role of the vendor assistant payment versus that. I assume that that's just a lower cost option for the state, so that that's been a value add.
It is.
Alternative. Great.
Thank you, and I think we'd like to give the Deputy Comptroller, Kevin Schober, a chance to respond to Chauvin. I'm sorry, Chauvin. Can't read my handwriting.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair, and Madam Co-Chair as well. And thank you for the opportunity. I know I wasn't on the agenda, but given the discussion today, I wanted to come and make sure that we clarified the Comptroller's position on a number of things here. My name is Kevin Chauvin, Assistant Comptroller of Fiscal Policy of the Office of the Comptroller. What I'd first like to make sure it's real clear, and again, appreciate to clarify this, that the Comptroller's position has always been to try to pay the bills, and she really takes pride in the fact that given when the state's worst financial crisis in managing the problems, the backlog when it reached the $17 billion a year and a half ago, that she's using every tool that it's afforded by the General Assembly and within our office and working with the agencies to manage this crisis. And today, I will say, even with a $6 to $7 billion backlog, we are very much in a triage of cash management policies to meet needs. We appreciate the group health insurance, the folk discussion on the group health insurance program, but the Comptroller's office certainly has got to also weigh in the education payments, the enhanced formula that is designed this year, the MAP grants, nursing home payments under the Medicaid program, so there are a variety of programs that we have to weigh on a daily basis, not just a monthly basis, but on a daily basis as revenues come in to try to dictate that put the resources where it's most meaningful to our citizens. And I hope you can appreciate that. With the group health insurance, to put it in perspective, a year ago when we had talked to some of you regarding the late interest penalties, the Comptroller felt that we first needed to make sure that there was a budget, because a year ago we weren't sure if we actually were going to have a full 12-month budget. So we wanted to make sure that, and once a budget was passed, we very much, at that time, we had about $3.5-4 billion in group health insurance bills. We felt that we could not make late interest penalties at that time until we tackled some of the principal. So you stop the clock when you pay principal, and the Comptroller felt that we needed to stop the principal in the best interest of taxpayers. And with such a large backlog of principal that was owed, we could not make any late interest penalties at that time. Since then, once we got a budget in May, we got some budgetary tools, the Treasurer's investment borrowing tool that some of you may have even sponsored, we were able to make ends meet through the rest of the year with making some payments to the late interest penalties. And we've paid over $250 million since that point of May of last year through the end of December. Now, the Comptroller also believes that if we're generating bills, bills that are generating interest that are over 90 days, it doesn't really make sense to continue us to use those resources. We need to pay, instead of paying late interest penalties, we need to pay the principal, and that's the best interest of the taxpayers. So beginning in the end of December, we made, after making $250,000 in payments in late interest penalties, we also started getting some additional medical bills, and so that were over 90 days. And up until March of just this last month, March 21st, we had over $2.1 billion in medical bills, of which over $600 to $700 million was generating interest. So clearly, we are doing our best what we can to do the interest when we can afford it, to pay the interest payments. But I hope you can understand that if we got bills that are generating interest, generating bills, that we try to also pay the principal as well. And so that's the balance act that we are trying to do. Also, when we deal with group health insurance, we're dealing with the health insurance revolving fund. There are other bills with other departments, such as Department of Corrections and other state agencies, that are more dependent on GRF payments and the late interest penalties. So just this last week, we were able to pay, I think, $30 million to the GRF side for the late interest penalties. So we've made some progress. We'd like to do better. But looking at $6 to $8 billion in backlog of bills, we are doing everything we can manage the whole problems in dealing with the principal and the late interest, as well as other programs with the state.
Yeah, I want to thank you right off the bat. The Comptroller's office has to do incredible work to try to manage the cash flow that the state of Illinois has and the budgets that are passed by the General Assembly, frankly. As we work to ensure that the taxpayers are not paying too much interest, We want to make sure that we are managing the relationships with the VSIs to make sure they are there so that our vendors can continue to work with the state of Illinois. And I know you understand how important that is. One question that I have, as you're paying interest, are you treating the VSIs the same way that you would treat the money that has been loaned from the general revenue fund from the treasurer, or are you paying the treasurer in a timely manner?
Now, when you say the treasurer, you're talking about the treasurer investment program?
Correct. We were talking about, yes, some of the money that's borrowed from the treasurer's office, it's paid at like 4%.
Right. So let me clarify that. So that was a special program that was designed up to $2 billion that the treasurer and the comptroller can enter in an intergovernmental agreement.
Yeah.
And since we don't have a real rainy day fund, I think there was $60,000 in there last time we checked. We use that treasurer's availability to use the liquidity in the state funds in order to help smooth out the ebb and flows of a fiscal year. So let's keep in mind that a year ago we had over $1.1 billion in supplemental items that were passed at the end of May, but certainly we could not afford to pay it until in that summer and that into that fall. So we were able to use the treasurer's funds up to $700 million. We did it in three tranches. And under that agreement, in the intergovernmental agreement, we had to pay it back within 6 months back to those funds. And I will say one of those funds was the income tax rebate fund. So while we saved their 12% interest going to 3.5%, we pay that 3.5%. The taxpayers actually win twice because you actually pay the taxpayer rebate fund that 3.5%. So we didn't have to pay the 12%. So that was an added bonus for using the treasurer's program. But the interest that is required to be paid under that, yes, under the IGA, that had to be paid back. And so the reason why we were able to borrow, we were fortunate to borrow it in the fall when revenues were low, because in October and November, revenues are really difficult in the state. But as people pay their income taxes in March and in April, we see an uptick. So we knew that we were able to afford to pay it back. So under the agreement, we paid the $700 million back. I think today or yesterday, we finally paid the final payment of that $700 million, and that includes the interest. And the interest, I think, was about, I don't have the numbers. We can get that to you, but that was included.
Okay, so there's, under the VSI, there's no such requirement to pay it. I mean, it says in a reasonable manner. What is reasonable?
Let me clarify, and we were talking about this before. When the state of Illinois borrowed the $6 billion, as Colin indicated, $3.9 close to $4 billion was paid on group health insurance bills. And that was after 2.5 years of not having a budget other than in the employee share going into the group health insurance.
Yeah.
So when that $4 billion was paid, that stopped a lot of principal. And that's when we finally got, probably 2 months later, we got the late interest penalties on that. Now, you could also say the same in terms of timing of how it's submitted to the comptroller's office with the Department of Corrections. So there was $400 million in bills that they could not pay. We eventually got a supplemental. We eventually paid that with the treasurer's money, but then the late interest penalties was over 3 years ago. So you have to put it in perspective of when it originally started. And when we look at making payments to the interest payments, we don't look at the voucher date because of the uniqueness of not having an appropriation. What we look at is the service date. So yes, we look at the service date, how far back it is, so that it's fair and it's parity of whether or not you get paid out of the HERF fund or you get paid out of GRF. And just this week, that $28 million or $25 million that we paid in GRF was to bring parity of the GRF fund up to HERF. So now everyone is at the same level in 2016. And I will add, you know, it's not unique that we do have other transfers that are still pending from 2016. We were just able to make some agriculture payments in transfers this week that were in 2016. So, the part of the backlog of $2.4 billion of this $6.2 billion backlog are these transfers, these government transfers that we have to make. So just want to put that in perspective for you.
Do we have any
Other questions from members? Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Sure. We're going to move on to the HMO. The HMOs. Can we get Blue Cross, Health Alliance, and Aetna? And members, we will take a vote after this panel. Okay, so if any vendors have any pending regulatory issues with the state agency or are under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state attorney general's office, please state that during your testimony. Thank you. Please introduce yourselves and we'll continue.
Good morning. My name is Sinead Rice Madigan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Health Alliance. I'm privileged to be before you today. And we've been a longstanding partner with Group Insurance for the state of Illinois, providing coverage for both active and retirees with the state of Illinois.
Robert Miller from Blue Cross Blue Shield, Vice President. We participate in the HMO benefit programs for the state. We are under a fully insured premium contract with the state, and we are not under any investigation or regulatory issues that I'm aware of.
Frank D'Antonio, Market President for Aetna. Proud to be offered to the state employees and their families on the HMO side for 35 years. We are offered on a fully insured basis as well. We also offer other products, which will keep me on the stand here for a while. The OAP product, the PPO product, and MAPD. No litigation that I am aware of.
I'm sorry, we were doing introductions. I didn't say that Health Alliance is not under any investigations at this time as well. Thank you.
Sure. Yes. We'll take a motion.
I'd like to make a motion pursuant to 5 ILCS 375-5. I make a motion to approve the proposed, renewed, and amended versions of the following managed care contracts for fiscal year 2020: Blue Cross Blue Shield Advantage HMO, Blue Cross HMO Illinois, Health Alliance HMO, and Aetna HMO.
Okay. We have a second. We'll open the roll.
Just opening the roll.
Senator Kaler votes aye. And I believe we have a question, Senator Severson.
Sure. Just, and maybe this may be a more of a question for CMS, but when we look at the plans that you offer, they're very rich plans. They're strong benefits with large networks, not the small, skinny networks like some of the in the private sector they've had to do to help reduce costs. So we got a strong plan and we've got a strong network, but I see limited wellness programs with real teeth in it, you know, programs that have stronger negative incentives to help force better health outcomes. And in the private sector, local municipalities, school districts, and in the private world, we're seeing changes in either lessening benefits for those individuals who don't want to get engaged into real robust health programs or health initiatives, or the richer benefits being rewarded for those who are being engaged in some of those stronger benefits. And I guess I don't see either here, which with their overall spend on the health portion, I think is about $2.1 billion, not having that benefit or not having those alternatives adds a lot of cost to this overall benefit. And I guess my quick question to you is, in the if you know, in other local governments that you deal with that have stronger wellness benefits or smoking surcharges or other initiatives, have you been able to see some substantial savings?
From a narrow network perspective, you're right on that in more of the private sector or the smaller municipalities, state government agencies, counties, cities, they have taken a look at more of our narrow networks, or what we call our value-based networks. And what happens with the value-based networks is typically not every provider is participating in that, because what we do as a carrier is we work with the providers to talk through and figure out how we're going to improve the quality of care in an area. And depending upon how that provider group is set up, whether they're totally vertical from primary care all the way up through, you know, specialty care, inpatient, outpatient, all those sorts of services, or if there's primary care groups that are, you know, out there. So we've contracted many different ways, and we have our what we call our broad network all the way through to our narrow networks to value-based networks, and in different parts of the country, we even go as far as what we call joint ventures, where we actually get in a 50-50 joint venture with different providers in those areas. We did, as we were proposing on the quality care plan, propose our narrow networks. Challenge with the narrow networks for a group like you is you cover the whole state. So you have constituency, you have employees, you have folks around the whole state. One of the reasons why you have three HMOs sitting up here today, because we don't potentially cover the whole state with providers. And that's not a bad thing, because we have maybe each one of our areas strength and focus in those areas. But what we have seen in other areas, maybe with union groups, where we have been able to improve the benefits, because you can't change the contributions, improve the benefits towards the more narrow network or value-based networks, that well over 50% of the people given in a certain area do enroll in those plans, and obviously then their costs are lower for what happens.
And I guess something, this, again, maybe it's a discussion more for CMS. I know it's something that would have to be negotiated, but the idea that we're offering a choice of three really high quality HMOs that are very rich, that have these kinds of benefits, to turn around then and say, we're going to give you these rich benefits, you're not going to be paying much for it, and we're not going to have any strong wellness. We just can't afford to do that anymore. And local governments have certainly done that. The private sector has done that. And we have found that in the local governments, whether it's school districts, municipalities, savings are 5 to 10% of reduction in costs if they're implementing significant wellness programs or smoking surcharges or adjustments in plans. And on a $2 billion system, it's pretty significant. And again, maybe that's not something it would be for yours, but maybe it's more of a question that we can talk further with CMS about. Is that as a potential issue that we need to look at is in negotiating? Can we continue to offer this kind of this quality of a plan without any kind of real health incentives in there. And again, the health incentives aren't meant to be punitive, but they're meant to drive better health outcomes for individuals as well. So we appreciate you being here. And I think the good news is, from a constituent standpoint, we hear very few or any complaints about the services and the care that happens. So we appreciate that. Thank you.
We're gonna, with permission of COGFA, we'd like to go ahead and take the vote on a attendance roll call basis. If nobody's opposed. Okay. Is there a motion? We made the motion. We had a second. So we can move forward on a vote of 11-0. The motion passes. I did have one quick question for you. Let's add Senator Harper. I'm sorry, Representative Harper. I gave you a promotion, right? So, quick question. Have you experienced any issues with the transition to the portal, or any additional costs as far as overtime or anything like that as we've transitioned to the new system?
This is Sinead with Health Alliance. We have not. We've worked well with Morneau-Chapelle in terms of reconciling enrollment and eligibility, and have worked with them on the dependent reviews as well. So it's gone fairly well.
Okay.
We've worked very strongly and well with Morneau-Chapelle. There has been a lot of bumps in the road that we've talked about each time that we've been here, but it's working smoother now than it has been in the past.
Great.
And that's really the same answer for Aetna as well. We've had some initial hiccups that we've worked through, and at this point I'm not aware of any issues that are outstanding.
So you feel like we've kind of smoothed everything out? I mean, obviously there may be a few more along the way, but been pretty well up to this point. Okay. Thank you. Thank you all. Now I believe we'll move forward, and obviously you can go ahead and get comfortable there. We're going to go with the OAPs. We've got HealthLink and Aetna as well. If you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Susan Laney. I'm the manager of HealthLink. I have been on the state of Illinois account since 2001. We have been working consistently with CMS on benefits and items that we can do to help our members make the better choices. We currently are in a 26-week delay, which represents about $259 million. And while before we were at 95 weeks, we were hearing a lot of noise from our providers, we are not hearing that noise. So the 6 months is much easier for them to handle. We do not have any litigations or issues going from a regulatory perspective. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Any questions of the committee? Unless you'd like to reintroduce yourself. Any questions of the committee?
No, I was going to maybe just add from our perspective. So this is a self-funded portion of what we offer to the state employees and their families. And we are upwards of 74 weeks pended with claims, although don't fixate really on that 74 weeks because that's a small part of the population. The major part of the population is 27 weeks behind. And this represents the vast majority of the membership that we offer. We're offered to is about 80,000 members. And the claims backlog is about $240 million.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Severson?
Just one quick one. It may not affect you. Maybe it's more of the health care side of it. Part of the problem with the delay in payments is when an employee gets their when they get their billing from the medical provider, it'll show what the bill was. It'll show then what the carrier paid and then what the employee portion is. When the state doesn't pay that bill for, you know, 6 months or 8 months, then the problem is that when that statement finally comes in, it doesn't give that math to the employee, and so it'll just show that a payment's been made, but then it becomes more of a difficulty from that. So I don't think a new EOB is a new EOB generated when the payment is actually then made to, for example, a medical provider?
No, from an EOB perspective, there's a member portal that the members have. They can access that. The EOB is available to them even when the claim has been paid but not released, and it will actually give them that information. When we receive the calls from providers indicating that they're being sent to collection or they're threatening to send them to collection, we create a copy of that EOB, send it to the provider, and ask them to remove that and let them know when they will receive the money. So we've actually been very successful from that perspective.
Yeah, you have been. It's been worked very well, so we appreciate that. So each of your websites, if they go on and create an account, they can then see that model that's on there.
That's correct.
And do you know how many people activate and go on to those sites?
There's about 62,000 that we have right now. 6,200, I'm sorry, compared to the 70,000 that we have. So we are constantly sending out information to them via an email and asking them to join the member portal and also telling them what they can experience with that, that there are so many things that we have available on our website.
And they do it, but your usage is less than,
yes,
way less than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's the same with us. The challenge we had over the last 2 years is transitioning the quality care plan from Cigna to Aetna. So we've seen an uptick in noise, as I call it, from providers up in the Chicagoland area, because that's where the majority of that quality care membership is. And so it does cause confusion, so you're right on that. And we've had some instances where we've had to call providers directly, and in some instances we had to go further than that, where providers were refusing to, help hold a member harmless, if you will.
It's frustrating because these are easy sites to work at, and if they go on there, they're not only information about their claims, but information about the products and the services and the network, and it's so easy, and yet so few people do it, but these members are spending plenty of time doing their Instagram and Facebook on their cell phones, but they don't open up their simple portal to learn about their benefits, and then they come here and complain about that information when it's all readily available. So thank you for doing that and for continuing to at least try to educate members to get onto those portals.
My pleasure.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Susan, thank you. We're going to move on to our quality care health plan. Frank, that's you.
All right, so one of the things that was brought up a little earlier, and a couple updates for you since last year. So talked about wellness benefits and what we can do with wellness benefits. And we've talked about this for many, many hearings, because you heard today what you all have lived through as state employees and representatives of the people of the state of Illinois is the fiscal crisis that's happened and what that really has done to the state employees and their families. Behavioral concerns, job concerns all lead to, you know, medical sorts of issues. So what we were asked many years ago is, what can we do to help as carriers? And so we took that to heart. Before I get to that, though, I do have to update you. Last year, as we talked about wellness and making sure we get the proper checkups and all that, you all asked me, kept asking, did I get my colonoscopy? I did. So we're good. Just wanted to let you know that I was going for 10 years, and I got my 10-year ticket, so we're all good. All right, so what have we done? Thank you. Thank you. I was a little worried. So what have we done for the state and their employees? As I mentioned earlier with the quality care PPO, we did put in there, in our proposal, wellness dollars. And what we've been able to do with those wellness dollars is we've really focused on what are called Higgy machines. And you all know kind of what these are. If you've gone around to the various state agencies and seen some of these, there's 23 that are out in various agencies today. We started rolling those out May of 18, and we're up to 23 today. So over the last 12 months, we've averaged about 23 machines, if you just took the total number and divide by 12. What these machines are is basically, you've seen these in the CVS's and in the Walgreens stores around, or Walmart's, where people kind of come and they sit down, and a lot of the time they're just taking blood pressure. But what these machines do is they go and do a whole biometric screening. And what we've been able to do is, from my opinion, is the right thing to help as many state employees and their family, regardless of what carrier they're offered, whether it's Health Alliance, Blue Cross, HealthLink, us, doesn't matter. And we've been able to track 59,133 health screenings over the last 12 months. Out of those 59,000 health screenings, 1,478 of the individuals are totally registered. So what that means is they've gone and they put all their information in. Again, it's carrier agnostic. It doesn't matter whether they're Aetna, they're Blue Cross, or CVS. 1,478 have put their total information in there. Of those 1,478 folks, they're averaging using this machine three times a month. So 252 of those 1,478, I'm sorry, are using the machine three times a month. They're constantly following up on, you know, their numbers. What that means is, out of the 58,000 or 59,000 plus screenings that we've had, these 252 folks have completed 9,100 of those screenings. So a good percentage of the total screenings. What we've also found is there are about 4,000 unique users. And how we come up with unique users is they haven't gone the distance as those 1,478 total registered, but the machine will be able to identify people with the same birth date, you know, height, weight, those sorts of things. So we know that there's 4,000 unique people that are using this as well. What I can't tell you on those 4,000 unique users is how often they're using it. But what we do know is 34% of the tests that have been done, or about 20,000 tests, have been done on males 50 to 59. That's about 53% of the population that has used these machines, 50 to 59 of them, or their age 50 to 59 of them. Your average age for your population, I believe, is 38 years old, which kind of falls in line with our normal book of business, whether it's commercial business or public and labor business. But what, and this will be opinion of mine, basically looking at the data, these individuals that are 50 to 59 and the amount of repeat users that we're using, this is a difficult population, going back to my comment about last year, to manage, because males in this age category aren't going to the doctor. So what we're seeing here potentially is, we talk about network access issues, we talk about people going to see the doctors, especially to get, you know, these screenings done. These individuals that are 50 to 59 really are using this Higgy machine to a certain degree as their doctor's office. They're going to get their visits there free. Again, carrier agnostic, doesn't matter which carrier they're with, but they're using this in a repeated methods. And basically, what we do know is we do know that more than anecdotally, we're making a difference. We do know that A stroke costs about $140,000. We know preemie babies can be upwards of $1 million to $2 million. We know heart attacks cost about $21,000 to $100,000 just for that episode. But we also know that we've had some testimonials, and again, I have no idea whether these testimonials are Aetna members, HealthLink, or Blue Cross, or Health Alliance. But I just want to tell you about a couple of them. One of them took the blood pressure health test on the Higgy, and it said to get to immediate care. That individual was admitted to the hospital with an early stages of stroke. Because they actually use these machines, so 59,000 screenings we saved potentially, well, someone's life, but also potential cost to the state of upwards of $140,000. There's a number of individuals that testified or gave us testimonials about their high blood pressure, and after, you know, being on the machine and doing it multiple times, they have struck up their relationship and gone and seen their primary care physician, and they are taking the appropriate medication, and they're getting their, you know, issue under control, and their lifestyle has improved. Last one I'll share with you is a expectant mother took the test and found out she knew she had high blood pressure and some other issues, but she didn't know the extent. After taking the test, she did get with her physician, and they treated her for preeclampsia. So that's not treated. There's potential there, again, for a premature baby or different sorts of things. So why we do this is because it's the right thing to do, in my opinion. Again, it's carrier agnostic, and what our goal is to continue to expand the 23 machines we have today over the next year or two. Our ultimate goal is to get to 100, and we have them distributed throughout the state and different agencies, but what we're also looking at doing as we go forward is, now that we're part of the CVS family, is how do we incorporate the 348 CVS pharmacies that are around the state and the upwards of 50 MinuteClinics into, you know, helping to coordinate care with the different providers that are out there and these individuals.
Two things. One is, are you getting any pushback on these putting these machines in any of the either state facilities or others at all?
Not to my knowledge. I think it was just a little bit slow to start out. That's why we were at four. But then we had a few things had to happen too on the startup. Is so we were four in May, ramped up to 10 in July, and then we really got going in January, got up to 19, and then 23 in April. Some of these had to be built. But I think there was a little bit of a hesitancy going, really, what are these sorts of things? But no real pushback at all. CMS has been fantastic to work with on this.
Good. And so, and again, this is just another example, a couple examples you gave, is why we need to be, and it's not meant to be punitive, but why this is really tough love to help these individuals. Again, we have municipalities. We've got one of our park districts that requires a bio screening for every employee. Now, if they don't do it, then they just pay more for their health insurance. And so there's a negative incentive to drive that behavior. But when you do those screenings, that's when you catch these things, and people are so grateful that they were pushed into doing that, and they were able to cover that. So as a state, when we're trying to figure out how we come up with money to make a budget work, the idea of offering rich benefits at low cost and not requiring, at least minimally bio screening, let alone, you know, more outcomes. But if we could do that, I think the savings could really be dramatic. So I appreciate what you're able to do. I wish we could give you some more teeth to be making it work even stronger. So I guess we'd like to have further discussions with CMS about how we can work on negotiating that with labor as a way to help lower costs so we can continue to allow rich benefits and good plans to everybody. So, but thanks for being on what you're already doing to bring those that wellness to light.
It's our pleasure. Two things, as I'll wrap up here then, is data is always a concern. So we're gathering data here, and so from an individual perspective, while we talked a little earlier about people on their cell phones and, you know, doing all those sorts of things, there's always a concern when it comes to this, and my employer is going to find out sort of thing. So as we move forward with making sure that people's information, and we do keep it confidential, you know, if we can answer those concerns, we can take away, I'm going to call it, a bit of a stigma of people that, you know, are afraid, you know, to go and use these sorts of things. So we do have to, you know, start that conversation.
Yeah, it's incredible how many, even though we offer wellness at 100%, no cost, no copay, no nothing, the huge number of people who don't take advantage even of it being free. So it's yeah, it's disappointing. So, but yeah, thank you.
And if it's okay for the commission, I'd like to have our team that has put this together stand and be recognized.
So that's you. You.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and next up is the Medicare Advantage plans: United Healthcare, Aetna, Humana, and Health Alliance.
Good morning, Dee Dee Rayback with United Healthcare. We have been partnering with Illinois since 2014. We offer a group Medicare Advantage PPO plan to your retirees. We cover approximately 130,000 of your retirees, and we are honored to be here, so thank you. We are currently not being investigated, or we are not involved in any kind of litigation. And thank you. I appreciate it.
Good morning. My name is Nisha Williams. I'm with Humana. We, too, have been working with the state on a Medicare Advantage plan since 2014. I am not aware of any litigation or investigations. We offer an HMO plan to your retirees in 13 counties, and we have about 5,500 members.
Got to scooch up here. Sinead Rice-Madigan, Chief Operating Officer for Health Alliance. Health Alliance has been offering a Medicare Advantage HMO in 48 rural counties in Illinois since 2015, and we have about 2,000 members.
And from an Aetna perspective, we have about 7,100 members.
And as folks have been transitioning over to the Medicaid Advantage plans, have anybody commented, or have you been getting complaints or concerns about people obtaining their prescriptions or keeping their doctors in place or being able to maintain their services at the preferred facilities? How's that transition been going? What kind of concerns have you been hearing?
So under the United Healthcare plan, it's a non-differential PPO plan, so whether the provider is in-network or out-of-network, it does not impact the member. Their benefits are exactly the same. So no impact there, no issues getting prescription drugs, and it is a national plan, so they can access care anywhere in the U.S.
For the Humana HMO, they do need to stay within our network except for emergency services, but I have not heard of any issues. We have a very robust network in the 13 counties that we serve, and I also have not heard of any issues regarding members receiving prescription drug coverage.
And as for Aetna as well, we have a limited geography. Network is identified, and no issues that I'm aware of with prescriptions or network adequacy.
Health Alliance is an HMO, so again, similar to what Humana said, they have to stay within the network. And we haven't had any complaints around prescription drugs in recent days.
So. Does anyone else have any other questions? All right, thank you. And I actually think that Aetna is not on the next panel now. Very nice. We are now going to other providers, so CVS, Caremark, yeah, so maybe somebody related to you. Delta Dental, Magellan, iMed, and Connect Your Care. We may not be able to fit all five up, so let's do CVS, Caremark, Delta Dental, and Magellan.
Good morning. My name is Julie Billingsley, and I'm a senior account executive with Magellan Healthcare. We administer the behavioral health benefits for the state's indemnity plan, which is quality care, as well as the employee assistance program for the state employees. We are not under investigation by any state or regulatory agencies.
Hi, my name is Karen Glagowski. I'm a Senior Vice President with Delta Dental. We administer the dental program for the state of Illinois. We also are not under any investigations by any regulatory agencies. And I'll turn it over to you.
My name is Darren Avant, and I'm the Senior Account Manager for the State of Illinois account.
And my name is Dan Foster. I'm the Strategic Account Executive for CVS Health. We manage the pharmacy benefit managements for around 150,000 state employees. At this time, I'm not aware of any litigation or ongoing investigations on our part.
I wanted to at least ask with dental. I know we've been had hearing in the past, at least, that some of the dental providers have been asking for payments up front. Is that still an ongoing or concern? Or are you still hearing about that, or is that easing up given at least people getting paid a little faster? What's the status?
That has diminished some. There are occasions when some providers may ask for payment up front. Providers who are in our network are not allowed to ask for payment up front. They can only ask for the member portion, which would be the deductible or any member portion of payment. When that occurs, we do reach out to providers to remind them of their contractual obligation. But just in general, we have seen less incidents of providers asking for payment up front.
All right, any questions? Either any of you? Okay, great. Thank you very much, and thanks for sticking with the state during slow payments.
Thank you.
iMed and Connect Your Care. And why don't we have Minnesota Life also come up on life insurance?
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair. John Nicolay, I'm the local counsel for iMed, and I'm joined by Emily Hazelton, who is a senior sales executive for iMed. Happy to be here.
Good morning. I'm Kirsten Elsner, and I'm an account executive with Securian Financial, the parent company for Minnesota Life Insurance Company. And Securian Financial has served the state of Illinois since 2001. We provide basic and optional life insurance coverage to over 200,000 state members and retirees. And to my knowledge, we are not under investigation or facing any regulatory litigation.
So what percentage of folks, you said 200,000 out of the pool of, like, what percent of folks are actually taking up on getting life insurance?
So the basic coverage is provided to all employees, and the optional coverage participation is at 45%, a little over 90,000 members.
Yep, Senator Severson.
On the Connect Your Care, how many members participate in that program? Do we know? Or do we have someone? And is that the...
I don't know if anybody... Is anybody here from Connect Your Care? They were from IMED.
Okay.
I don't think they're here.
All right. I'm a little concerned who IMED is who's representing IMED, but that part's a little bit concerning, but despite that, thank you. Okay, well, we'll connect with them later.
Okay, any other questions? Great, thank you. And I think we'd just like to quickly ask Director Ford to come back up and maybe just talk a little bit about the wellness programs that I know Senator Severson has been asking about and see whether you have any plans or intent to try to address and do more wellness care in the group health program.
Oh, goodness. Well, thank you for your time this morning. I will be brief in that I'll ask Teresa Flesh to talk a little bit more about the wellness program. What I will say is that as we continue to have the productive conversation that we are having with our labor partners, we're looking to think about everything that we can include in our health plans going forward. So wellness is absolutely part of the conversation.
I guess the question would be is, I know that some of this has to be negotiated, but is that something that would make sense to add to the list, some mandatory, not just the, the problem with voluntary wellness programs is that historically the only ones who participate in voluntary wellness programs are people who are going to do that anyways. It's those negative incentives that really drive behavior and savings. And so even though there's pushback sometimes, given a choice, do you want to maintain a rich plan? If so, this is what you've got to do, as opposed to saying we can't give you rich plans, big networks, low cost, and those days are over. Again, local governments have all had to make those changes. And it's not meant to be punitive, because all you have to do is talk with these individuals who say, thank you for forcing me to do that, because otherwise I wouldn't realize that I had this problem or that problem. And so is that something that that you could bring back to as part of the negotiations, and just saying you have a choice of either, lessening benefits or paying more, or doing some kind of mandatory, minimally biometric screening, or and do you have smoking surcharges at all in your rates either?
No, we do not. Okay. We do not.
Which, again, most most plans have that in place, mm-hmm. which would, again, either drive better behavior or having those who are smoking paying more. But most local governments and private sector does that as a as another way to do that. So is that something it can be part of the negotiations, and are those negotiations forthcoming? Do you know?
So we are currently, so first of all, thank you for your commentary. I am familiar with wellness programs in a previous life. But what I would say is, we are at the table, we are having discussions, and everything is on the, literally is on the table, and healthcare, of course, is an important part of that conversation. And again, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but what I will say is that our partners have been open to learning and understanding different ways about thinking about healthcare. So, and wellness will be a part of the I anticipate wellness being a part of the continued conversation.
Okay. And if you could keep us up to date on that, because again, if we're looking at a $2 billion cost, even at a minimally of 5%, which most with a mandatory bioscreening get more than that, you're talking about $100 million savings. Mm-hmm. And at a time when we can't pay our bills, that's a significant amount of budgetary savings without taking any benefit away or any cost to anybody. It's just helping them. So if you could keep us informed with those negotiations or what anything we can do to help, that would be we'd appreciate that.
Thank you. We will.
All right. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I think we have concluded our business for the day, so we will adjourn this meeting of CACFA. Thank you. Thank you.